back to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor, as well as writer and producer on Criminal Minds.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where I work with Jim Clemente. And you know what? We just got our season 12 pickup.
Yay. Woohoo! We're pretty happy about that.
Yeah.
Thank you for being fans of that show as well. Laura Richards is not with us here today, but she will be back shortly, and we will continue to be giving commentary on real crimes. So, today, we're going to continue with answering listener questions, and first one I want to address is from, I'll just say the initials are EK, and this listener wanted to thank us for the podcast and also share something that that has been on their minds when they had listened to our podcast. So they were talking about hearing all of our agony about justice not being served for Nicole and Ron in the OJ case. But they said this: at any rate, my thought is, for a black juror, any black America, weighing the scales of justice, on the one side you have two brutally slain white people who lived a rarefied life of privilege. On the other, you have legions of murdered and brutalized brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters dating back generations that continues right up till today. No black American can escape the legacy of trauma, violence, and systematic devaluation of their lives done to them by white Americans. So this small group of representatives of black America received the unlikeliest of all unlikely powers, to spare one black body and thereby give proverbial finger to the whole white criminal justice system, who has and continue to inflict such grievous damage to their people. As horribly undeserving as OJ was of being saved, I do understand the possible motivations. Okay, well, I get what you're saying, and I would like to respond to a couple of things here. First of all, the justice system is not white. Law enforcement is not white. They may be majority, the people in it may be majority white, but there are certainly tens of thousands of law enforcement officers. If I would say more like 100. You know, I think there's 500,000 law enforcement officers in the United States. There's at least 100,000 or 200,000 that are non-white. So to say that it's a white justice system, I think, is a fallacy. I do think that African Americans and other minorities have been discriminated against. It's a matter of record. It's horrible. And I certainly don't condone any of that. But the flaws in the system are the individuals who exploit the system to take out their biases or their ignorance on people that don't look like them, don't act like them, don't, you know, behave like them. So I think the fact, it'd be nice if you could put this into a black and white issue. It'd be nice if you could so carefully pigeonhole it. But unfortunately, that's just not accurate, and it's not the case. As I said before on earlier podcasts, with human behavior, it's incredibly diverse. And unfortunately, some people don't like the diversity of other races, of other cultures, of other ways of looking at things. But that is not, and I can definitely say this, it is not the rule. That is an aberration. It doesn't happen by every single person. And certainly not the only people that are doing things bad against African Americans or minorities are not white. I mean, there are plenty of black on black crimes. It's a horrible thing, and it's more a social situation than it is a racial situation. It is typically situations in which that there are drugs and poverty and lack of services and all sorts of negative pressures on people's lives that make them act to their extreme. Stress does kill, and it kills other people too. And I think that is more what is going on when you're talking about, you know, crimes in very poor or very violent neighborhoods. But again, doing this, if this is what actually happened, if what this listener has actually said was the African-American community basically giving the finger, the proverbial finger, to the white justice system, I think it's still just as much of a shame, it's still just as much of injustice to the victims of that crime, and it is sad that that what I believe happened in this case was Johnny Cochran was able to manipulate the public into believing that this trial was all about a race issue when it was about the brutal murders of two people. The last thing I will say is, although Nicole may have become a wealthy white woman living the life, she certainly was taken advantage of. She was beaten. She was terrorized by O.J. Simpson. She did not live, a incredible, rarefied life of privilege. She led a haunting life under the thumb of O.J. Simpson. And Ron Goldman was a young guy, a nice guy, did a lot of volunteer work, wasn't wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but he did have access to people who were. This is just typically the way that people looking from the outside may think that somebody who has money or somebody who lives in Beverly Hills or works in Beverly Hills must be wealthy and have a great life. The fact is that people of all walks of life have problems, especially with domestic violence. This case was a domestic violence murder. It should have been investigated that way. It should have been prosecuted that way. Unfortunately, it was prosecuted as a racial murder.
So, do you have other things you want to read?
I have another email from a listener who wanted to make a recommendation. Now, I have not read this book, but it's a book that's set in the 1960s and 70s in Australia. It's called The Blood on My Hands, and I'll read you the description. It's a heartbreaking yet riveting narrative of a childhood spent in pain and terror, betrayed by the people who were supposed to provide safety and understanding. The strength and courageous resilience it took for O'Leary to not just survive and escape from her father, but to flourish, heal, and triumph over the unimaginable trauma she endured as a child is both powerful and moving. Sounds like a very interesting and courageous story, and as I said, I haven't read the book, but it is something that sounds exactly like the kind of voice we need to hear, the difficult things we need to hear about how people can survive devastating trauma and still heal and go on to thrive and have wonderful lives. I think hope is something that we need to give everybody who survives any kind of trauma, because it does not have to ruin your life.
Right. And because you brought up, sounds like this was a child victim that she's talking about. In that case that you represented, that 8-year-old boy, were his parents there, or did he have an advocate with him when he was...
Unfortunately, there was victim services, but at the time they weren't allowing victim services to be as involved in the courtroom as they can today. They didn't have things in place. Like today, victims can have the opportunity, for example, child victims, to testify in another room for a closed circuit camera, and things like that that really weren't happening that back then, at least not in the Bronx. And victim services are much more can be much more involved and sort of take the burden off the prosecutor from keeping a witness involved and still coming back time after time after time. I mean, it's so terribly re-victimizing of the victims to have to come back over and over and over again, to disrupt their lives, to have to tell their stories over and over and over again. So I think that in today's world, that victim would have been much better served. It's just sad that back in the day that that he wasn't.
Well, I was going to say that in Los Angeles, and I know other places too, there is CASA, which is the court-appointed special advocates for children who can be with the child, you know, walk them through the process, make it much less scary for them, especially if they don't have parents who can, you know, who can be with them, or if the parent is actually the abuser or whatnot. And it's an organization that I've wanted to get involved with, and I know one of our listeners is involved with. So if I do pursue it, I will definitely let people know that this is something that you can volunteer for. They train you for it, and you can be there for a kid. And I know that when I was on the stand testifying against the story that I talked about the boy who was stabbed in the throat, and I was the witness, you know, and I was really terrified, and there was nobody there really to hold my hand through right. that process. So that's something at a future date that I will do some research on and let people know about that. But if you want to look into it yourself, it's CASA, C-A-S-A, and you can look that up and see if you'd like to become a volunteer or an advocate. Okay, so moving on, on our last podcast, when we wrapped up the O.J. Simpson verdict for the FX show, we did talk about a listener letter who wrote very emotionally and expressively about feeling offended by comments about the jury, about offended that we didn't think that those jurors were capable of understanding, were capable of each having their own opinion and coming to the conclusion they did. And well, we talked about it, yeah, you know, we
but
talked.
There was absolutely never any mention of that. I thought those jurors were not capable of understanding.
Yes, you did.
Of understanding
no, the science.
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I never said that those jurors on the OJ jury were not capable of understanding. I said juries who are not educated are not capable of understanding all the science. I wasn't talking about just those jurors.
Okay, yeah.
I was talking about the jury system. Yeah. We weren't talking about the OJ jurors at that time. I was talking about, I said, I want to make a comment about mm-hmm. the jury system at the time. So I wasn't saying that any individual on that jury was incapable of understanding it, but that in general, because juries are not professionals, the understanding level of very complicated science is lacking. And in order to make an actual reasoned determination, not just on some superficial explanation that you could put on in a trial in a few days or weeks of testimony, that is actually not making an accurate decision based on the evidence that's there. I think it's a flawed system because not only, I'm not talking just about science. I mean, mm-hmm. there's incredibly complicated insurance issues. There's incredibly complicated political and financial issues in the trials. And those things also, the experts are coming in to testify about this stuff, but they're experts in that field. They're not necessarily experts in communicating that information in a simple way to people who don't have any level of understanding or education in that area. And I think that's a really important distinction than making it sound like I was making a comment that those particular jurors could not understand this case. Like, there was something wrong with those jurors.
Okay. You know, I apologize because that conversation came from talking about Dr. Fung and that you said that, you know, he has all this experience and so much experience. How could the jurors possibly understand what he was talking about?
Right. And how could any jurors? I wasn't talking about that 12 people. I was talking about any civilian jurors who are not scientists, who don't mm-hmm. understand, you know, biochemistry and genetics, that it's impossible for them to really. They can say, oh, 1 in 170 million, that's a big number. But, well, there's a lot of people in the world. So there's a whole bunch of other people that could have done this. Well, you need to explain it, break it down, and say, well, actually, no, that's not the case. I mean, you also have to look at the populations that had access to this crime scene. Of the people, when you look in the LA area, there are only maybe 20 million people within a 100-mile radius of this crime scene. And there's certainly a lot less than 170 million. So, like, you could expand it to the entire state of California, Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, and say, out of all those people, there's only one person who could have committed this crime. And I don't think that was done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand it. I'm mm-hmm. a prosecutor. I'm a scientist. I'm an investigator. I understand it pretty well. I could have explained it a lot better, I think, to them. But the way Fung did it, I don't think so. I think he was a very stiff, socially awkward scientist who had no experience at all in communicating to other people.
Well, I'm going to read some excerpts from some of the books that were written by the jurors in the in the aftermath and see what they have to say about that, which, of course, is hindsight. You know, you can't necessarily trust that. But anyway, so our listener, Valencia, was very kind enough to let me repost her letter at the top of our Facebook feed. And we had just a great back and forth with a lot of our listeners, some who understood her point of view, some who didn't. But it was a very civil and understanding and insightful back and forth. And I really want to just give a shout out to our listeners for, you know, allowing the space for other people's opinions. And I just think it's really lovely. We've had very few people just flying by to post, "You suck," or "You're stupid," you know, very few, very little of that. And so I want to commend our listeners for that.
Yeah, that's great.
However, should we talk about your other theories about the jury system and the problems you have on it, with people not being scientists or professionals? Or, I mean, what's the alternative? Would you have, just tell me, what if we're not going to have the average Joe and Jane and citizen from whatever walk of life being on the jury that you've never served on, what's the alternative?
What do you mean that I've never served on? What are you trying to say? So you, as a juror who only was exposed to, how many trials have you served on as a juror?
One.
Okay, one. So your one experience in a jury is vastly better than my experience actually trying cases and my experience actually being in an investigator in cases and testifying in cases and then going and actually interviewing the jurors afterwards and finding out what happened and why the verdict was the way it was.
I'm not saying I'm better than you. I'm just saying that if you had been in a jury situation, I think it'd be very interesting to see what you came up with. And I'll talk about my jury experience in a minute. Okay. But...
well, why don't you talk about it now? So let me know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I feel like you're going to hate how we did it. Because I think, okay, one thing that one of the jurors said in the OJ trial that was not covered in the show is Ito's direction to them about what they should or shouldn't do in their deliberations. And as a juror myself, I didn't know that there was anything wrong with when you just walk in, you know, you've been with these people for a few hours, you don't know anybody's name, you don't, you know, you're sitting around, you're kind of looking at each other like, okay, we get to talk about this. And the first thing we did was nominate a foreman, and then we took a poll where we raised our hands to say, right now, what do you think right now? If we had to vote, you know, if we had to give a verdict right now, what would it be, guilty or innocent? Unanimously, we all raised our hands, and we looked around. We all thought the same thing. And then we all said, well, we need to talk about this. We can't just because we're all in agreement. We need to discuss it. And so we did. And we discussed it, blah, blah, blah.
But
and
you then know that jury polling is supposed to be anonymous,
but
right?
No, that's the thing. We what? Did not know that. That's well, what I'm saying. It's like, I think...
But can you see that it's possible that when 10 or 11 other people raise their hands when somebody asks the first question, how many people think this person is guilty or how many people think this person is innocent? Do you think that maybe there are people in that jury room that would have been swayed by that did not want to be the person to raise their hand?
Sure. That certainly could have been true. And, you know, we said, should we take a poll? We just, you know, nobody said, I don't feel comfortable with that, whatever. Yeah, it could have been.
There are people that wouldn't be comfortable saying,
sure.
I'm not
yes,
comfortable.
Yes, I hear you. We could go, yes.
I know.
Yes. So, but then when we discussed it, a couple people said, because we didn't have to be unanimous in this civil trial, you know, just had to be. A couple people said, well, I'm just going to vote not guilty just because I,
more
you know, they wanted more balance. And we're like, okay, you know. And so I had a really positive experience and two different ethnicities. Those ethnicities were represented in the jury, and the forewoman was one of the ethnicities, and she voted that the guy was guilty, and she, you know, she didn't take a side. Nobody seemed to take any sides as far as the racial makeup.
I can pretty much guarantee that there wasn't one of the attorneys in the trial going out during the course of a nine-month trial and holding rallies and getting people all riled up and threatening riots and so forth like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm not saying they were. I'm just saying this is just my experience. So,
But all I'm saying is that I do believe that that information was very much available to the jurors on the OJ trial. Mm. That what was going on the outside was bleeding into the jury, even the sequestered jury.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
I just think, you know, how to be, I, like I said, I had no idea that that was the wrong thing to do, to take a poll. I mean, you're not
well,
given that.
It's not that it's a wrong thing to do. I mean, in other words, like, I can understand in the mind of you and the jurors, I don't think it was a deliberately erroneous thing to do. But the whole process is supposed to be one that gives people the ability to vote their conscience and not feel, you know, pressured into going one way or another. But as I said earlier in earlier podcasts, there's a thing called jury nullification that, that happens. It's a reality. Judges don't talk to juries about it. But it is in the face of overwhelming evidence of guilt that a jury goes a different way because of emotion or because of situations that have nothing to do with what's actually going on in the trial. And that is, it's a concept, you can all look it up, you can, you know, it's defined because it's happened in experience. I think the OJ case is a perfect example of it. And despite the fact that the defense raised a whole bunch of things like Colombian neckties and all this other crap, that they were able to sidestep the actual issues in the case and got people to vote a particular way based on race. I mean, it was very clear, at least in the depiction on the show, again, I was not in that jury room, and I don't know if all of the African-American people voted right from the start for innocence, and two white people voted for guilty. I didn't read the jurors' books. Did they say anything about that?
Yeah, they. All right. So just to read from some of the see the jurors' point of view since we've been talking about them. So this is a little excerpt from the Michael Knox's book. He was the one who was ejected from the jury. Yeah, he was like he was the one who was ejected because he had some domestic abuse in his background.
Well, the issue that he said, I didn't really kidnap her. I just took her around in the car a few times around the block and so forth. That one.
That's right. So he says, I felt sorry for OJ, but I'd made no judgments about his guilt or innocence. But for the first time, I heard the prosecution outline the evidence that was overwhelming. He tended to think that he was guilty. He says, but at the end of the day, I sat with the other black jurors and realized immediately that they had been as deeply affected by what I'd heard. They were as deeply affected by what we'd heard as I had been. Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden and the rest of the prosecution had a great case, but they never knew how to present it. They couldn't just keep it sharp and simple. They fumbled and fretted, constantly referring to each other. Sometimes they got together, but mostly their presentation was sloppy, badly organized, ineloquent, even though the evidence itself was very powerful. For the black jurist, Simpson was one of our own. He was a brother, and he was in trouble. I know it's difficult and frustrating for white people to understand that, but deeply held belief in our community is the black men who rise high are eventually brought down by the white establishment, and that the police are quick to railroad black men. So
And what do you think he would have said had he actually walked into OJ's house and saw that there wasn't a picture of OJ with African-American people, that there were blonde chicks on the wall. There were all his white golfing buddies. Actually, OJ was a part of the white establishment. And to say that he was a brother means that they believed what they were sold by Johnny Cochran when he manipulated the evidence in that case. And that was the everything that was in OJ's house. Everything was Africanized and everything was African-Americanized. And it just shows again how unjust that system was. I think that if they had actually seen what OJ's life was like, and if the prosecution actually could put in evidence about that, because it clearly influenced these jurors, at least from this guy's perspective, that it is something that was an injustice that Judge Ito allowed, and it's just a shame.
But I don't think it's as simple as that, because he does go on to say that even with all that, even knowing he's a brother in trouble and all that, he was skeptical about the defense's theory that the Los Angeles Police Department conspired against Simpson.
I mean, he's still
he's saying that he could still see that. He could still see both sides. He could still recognize that he,
I'm not saying that he couldn't, mm-hmm. but he did say first, I got together with the other black jurors. Why did he get together with the other black jurors? Why didn't he get together with all the jurors? He is already admitting there's a racial divide. Mm-hmm. And that is something that he can't, and he admits, he can't get away from. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it automatically makes every African-American person a blinded to whatever evidence is put in the case. But I am saying that this guy is showing, there's leakage here, and mm-hmm. even how he presents it, that he is actually swayed in a way that a jury is not supposed to be. A jury is supposed to be impartial. Mm-hmm. And maybe what they need to do is put up a wall. And maybe they need to, if you know the defendant at all, then you can't be involved in this trial. If you know who he is, it's so hard to convict a celebrity mm-hmm. just because almost everybody knows who they are.
One thing I want to ask you is, why is it that the jury can't deliberate the whole way through? Why do they have to...
I agree with you.
Oh, you do? Okay,
oh, absolutely.
Okay, good.
I've been saying this for years. I mean
it seems
ridiculous.
Crazy.
For a nine-month period, nobody... I mean, you cannot, in detail, recall what happened 9 months ago. You can't recall what happened in detail 3 weeks ago, and you have to know the details.
Right.
First of all, it should be... They should have a current, live transcript of everything that's testified to. They should have it video and digitally recorded for them. Mm-hmm. And they should have access in the jury room to all that information. Mm-hmm. They should be able to go through it every time they want to and not have to remember, wait, was that first cop the one that I thought was sneaky or slimy or something? Was that third witness the one? Was that 27th? Was that 157th person that took the stand? The guy that I really believed? I mean, it's ridiculous to require people to think. It's a fallacy. It's a fallacy to think that they could actually do it. Yes, I agree with you completely. They mm-hmm. should be able to deliberate as the evidence comes in. They should be able to document it. And they should be able to say they should not make any attempt at voting or any attempt at mm-hmm. convincing other people. Mm-hmm. They should discuss what they felt. Because what's great about what I did in the behavioral analysis unit was that we would get in a room, a round table, not unlike a jury room, and go through the evidence of a crime. We'd look at victimology, we'd look at the crime scene, we'd look at the offender behavior, and we would profile that case. And every single time I was in that room, I had a perspective based on my education, training, history, and I would look at things. And then somebody else would say, and then I'd challenge them, and they'd challenge me. And in the end, we worked something out. We came to a reasonable conclusion based on that. And then we look for corroboration of those reasonable conclusions, and we went to see, because, you know, we do not learn anything about the suspects when we're doing the profile. But then when we got more information, we got things corroborated, we asked more questions, it went from a reasonable conclusion to, you know, to probable cause that this happened, more likely than not, to beyond a reasonable doubt, this is what we feel, you know, mm-hmm. and then at that point, then we make the conclusion that this is who we think did the crime. This is the kind of person that did the crime. Now, let us look at the defendants and see, or suspects, and see if any of them fit that. And that process taught me a great deal. Not only that, you know, that my perspective was important, but that the perspectives of everybody else in the room is equally important, and you have to be open to it. And it's great because everybody has different experiences. And so that would improve the jury process tremendously. You can't live with this fiction that everybody's going to remember everything about the first witnesses. So if you do let them deliberate and you let them document that process, then when they get to the final point, when the trial is over, then I think they should have to go back and look at all that documentation along the way. I think that would actually refresh their recollections. It would get them really, they would be so much more involved. It would mean a much greater commitment by jurors because they would actually have to go through the trial, maybe not the whole trial, but basically their deliberations a second time. But then they can say, well, but Sally, don't you remember when you saw this witness? You were really impressed with this. You told me about it. I didn't even think about that. And then you told me about it. Now you're saying the opposite. What happened? Explain that, please. And I think that process would be, I would love to be involved in that process, first of all. I love that kind of process.
Yeah.
But I think that would really help, because you would be much more, it'd be a much more reasonable set of expectations for a juror. I don't believe that they can, especially a 9-month-long trial, remember what the initial witnesses were. It probably really hurt the prosecution in this case, by the way.
Where does that rule that you can't...
It's a procedural rule. It's just the rule. There's no
It must come from somewhere,
reason.
Though. There was
well,
somewhere.
We were... Go ask the British. I mean, we base it on their
program. Laura, this is your fault.
Where the hell are you? I mean, we base it on... We have some very different rules. Ours have evolved differently from the UK rules, but that's where ours came from, and theirs probably came from Roman times. I mean, this is just something that has evolved in law over history, and there's no actual scientific behavioral proof that they can do what we ask them to do, jurors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much proof that they cannot, and this is why we get emotional verdicts.
What would be the process to changing the rule? I mean, is there a process?
Sure, it would be you wouldn't have to have a constitutional amendment, but mm-hmm. what we do, it would be the federal rules of procedure. You do it in the federal level, and then hopefully it trickles down to the states. If the states, if the U.S. Supreme Court makes a decision and says that this guy, let's say in a particular case that came up to them, he didn't get a fair trial because it was 15 months from the time that the evidence was put on till the time they actually deliberated,
mm-hmm.
and that's not a fair trial, then that trial gets overturned, and then they have a federal rule saying you have to let them deliberate from day one,
mm-hmm.
and then some state doesn't do that, and somebody in a state court then files an appeal, and it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finds that state's law is unconstitutional, then they start changing all the states. I mean, it's a long, drawn-out process, years and years. Every step of that would be years in the making. So, but
it seems like it's
done.
Worth it, though. It seems like...
I would think so. I think there's a lot of jury reform that should be done, and I think it needs to be done. I mean, it could be done in this way. For example, you said you were on a civil case. What was the topic? What was the suit about?
It was about a car accident.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay, so did they have the MATE team, the state police? It's the MAIT team. It's Motor Accident Investigative Team, I think.
No, there was no
okay.
law enforcement.
Well, these are guys that are specifically trained to do accident reconstructions. And they have all the software and the technical abilities to do that. And they can actually create sort of, an actual visual recreation of the accident. And those guys are incredibly well-versed at it. I think that if you have an accident like that that requires that you should have either jury members or jury consultants in the room from both sides presenting that to them. So it's not just what the prosecution deems appropriate. I mean, if you had, there's no reason why we can't have experts, maybe three, let's say prosecution, defense, and neutral, and basically have three people that are either part of the jury or on subject matter experts that are part of the jury that can actually answer the questions that the jurors have.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't know if you would agree with this or not, but why can't the jury ask questions throughout? He's smiling. Clavetti's smiling.
Because there's no reason why they can't. It's, again, it's just a rule of procedure, but they are able to ask questions not throughout, but at the end of a grand jury presentation, for example. They're allowed, when somebody comes and testifies in front of a grand jury, the grand jurors are allowed to submit questions. The prosecutor then asks the questions of the witness, or can bring other witnesses that will answer the questions. I think that's a reasonable thing. It would keep them more involved in it. This whole fallacy of, like, I mean, and it's really even worse when you get to Great Britain. Sorry, Laura, but, wearing these goofy wigs and, You have like they have to like stand in some box and the defendant is over there in a cage. I mean, you know, we see that as barbaric. We see that as tainting the jury, you know, the impression of the defendant. We let the defendant come in for the trial without handcuffs on and all that stuff and in a suit and things like that so that they don't look like a convict. And I did air quotes there, by the way, or inverted commas.
Inverted commas.
Laura says. But I think there are a lot of things, there are things in their justice system that they don't do that we do. For example, the Supreme Court has said it's okay for detectives to lie and mislead people that they're interrogating during the course of an investigation. When they get on the stand, they have to tell the truth. All right, it's a little inconsistent, but what they do is they actually take into account psychology and how you get people to tell the truth by misleading them. If you do it in a way that actually carefully avoids coercion, for example, you can't lie to them and say, oh, by the way, you're going to get the death penalty if you don't tell me the truth right now. I mean, that is coercion. You know, it doesn't wrongfully influence them, like in the Brendan Dassey case, by giving him options and letting him guess. And I mean, once he starts saying, what else did you do to her head? And he said, cut her hair. And they're like, what else? Punch her? What else? Stab her? I mean, when you see a guy doing that as a detective, that should raise a red flag in your head. Oh, wait, this guy seems to be guessing. He's not telling me what happened. This is not the process that we can get involved in. You know, this guy is not a good witness. We need to get him mentally evaluated. We need somebody to talk to him who understands his cognitive level, because it's not where we are. Mm-hmm. So like I said earlier, it could have been that they just didn't understand that fact. They just think, oh, he's dumb, but he's going to tell me the truth. Well, no, he's going to be easily manipulated. Those people are easily controlled. We have a behavioral analysis questionnaire that we've developed in the behavioral analysis unit that helps us to understand just by indirect, by asking questions of other people around the person, based on the NEO personality inventory, to be able to tell if they're somebody that's easily coerced, if somebody who's prone to a false confession. So we've done things to try to avoid that as a possibility. And then, of course, the thing that you do that the DA prevented from happening is you ask them questions that weren't made part of the record.
Yes.
But once the DA tells everybody in the world everything they think they know about it, that becomes now the narrative. So I don't know if I answered your question.
So we're just getting back to juries asking questions and how, you know, they can ask to see the transcripts. But it, like, if somebody's having a hard time understanding the DNA, then that's a perfect time for the jury to say, can somebody explain it better? Can you know?
And as far as I know, they can't see the transcripts, but they can either hear, they can have the transcripts read to them, or they can hear the testimony again. I don't know if they can actually be given the transcripts. Were you given the transcripts?
Oh, we didn't ask for any.
I think they hear the testimony again. Either somebody reads out the testimony, or they actually listen to the testimony.
Why?
Again,
these
are all really good questions. It is the way it's done, and it's a huge, immovable force. It's supposedly to protect the integrity of the jury process. To me, it's ignorant. It's so steeped in the past and false beliefs, and I think we need to change it.
Well, I do too, and I'm glad we agree on this. I'm going to get back to another book that was written by three of the jurors on the OJ trial. It's called Madame Foreman, and I just want to tell you what they have to say about why they came to the conclusion they did. So she's saying that they did actually see Johnny Cochran showboating, that they could see that. They were appalled by Johnny Cochran, especially during closing arguments. They thought Marcia Clark more professional, but were angered at her blatant expression of frustration during the trial and what they considered her attempt to pander to emotion in her closing. They disliked Mark Furman, they knew he was a liar, and so they just discounted everything he said. They repeated many times the concern that the prosecutors and defense attorneys treated Simpson jurors like a bunch of illiterate, ignorant people. Yes, they got bored with DNA testimony, but mainly because Dr. Robin Cotton talked down to us like we were illiterates. However, some spoke at our level, like the DNA experts Gary Sims of the State Department of Justice or defense attorney Barry Scheck, that they learned more about DNA from them.
How did they learn from a defense attorney? That's wrong. A defense attorney should not be teaching anybody on the jury a damn thing. That's just not how it's done. Barry Scheck should not be explaining DNA to a jury. They should have had an expert do that. He can ask the questions, and maybe that's what she's referring to. But I don't think they actually learned anything about DNA from Barry Scheck. But he's a brilliant guy, incredibly good at communication, and very dedicated to writing wrongful convictions. So I have a lot of respect for him and the work he's done.
He founded the Innocence Project.
The Innocence Project, yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
All right. So they also felt manipulations were made by the white-controlled Los Angeles law enforcement system towards the predominantly black jury. When prosecutor Bill Hodgman disappeared and Christopher Darden played a more prominent role, Cooley suspected the first race card, as it has come to be called, to be put into play.
They didn't know.
They didn't know.
A heart attack.
Right.
And that Darden was on the team that was backing them up. But I'm sure that that is not, absolutely not, the first race card that was played. But it may have appeared that way to the jury. Do you not recall jury selection? Do you know that was a process? Do you know why a lot of people were added onto the jury by the defense? And why some of them were voted against by the defense? That was all part of the race card being played.
Well, to them it looked like his white superiors said, well, Chris, maybe you can communicate with them things that we're not able to communicate with them. While she respected Darden despite his very moody demeanor, she felt his presence didn't fool me, and it didn't fool a lot of the other people on the jury either. So basically they started to have a lot of mistrust in the police, and she cites Robert Risky, the first police officer to arrive at the scene of the murders, seemed an honest officer but untrained. He did not seem to know how to preserve a crime scene, could have walked in the blood when he stepped over the bodies, should never have used the Bundy house phone to call in the crime, since, as Cochran said, if you had not used that phone, we could have found out who Nicole Simpson called last. And their questions about the law enforcement mounted.
So let's take this at a time. This is why when police officers who respond to a scene call a detective, because they are trained. If you want every police officer to be trained to that level, what you need to do is spend about 40 or 50 or 100 times more on law enforcement than you do now. It's impossible to do that. LAPD has been at about 65% of what their manpower should be for decades. Mm-hmm. They can't get enough people to become cops. They don't get paid enough. It's a very difficult job. The antagonism of the community towards the police is extremely high. Maybe it was well deserved, but this is not the result of somebody deliberately trying to trash a crime scene. This is the result of somebody coming to a crime scene and not knowing what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know why he didn't have a radio. Maybe he used the phone because he thought, I don't want this out over the radio because then the press is going to be here. I'm actually protecting Nicole by doing this. And he made an error, but that is not unusual in law enforcement because he literally is untrained because they don't have the money to train cops like that. I mean, I wish that they could train cops like that. However, again, as a result of this very case, cops were trained better. They do know a little more about staying away from the actual evidence of the crime scene, but you have to also remember, one of the jobs of a cop, first cop arriving on the scene, is to see if he can save lives. I mean, so if in that process some of the forensic evidence gets trampled on, I mean, you still have to try to save the life. Mm-hmm. And had they been alive rather than dead, then EMTs would have been called, and they would have been treated medically and brought to the hospital, and forensic evidence be damned. Because at that point, you would hope at least that they would be able to be testifying against the person. Unfortunately, that process, of the cop responding and probably checking their vital signs to see if they were alive, although I think that they were probably so bloody he may not have even done that. I don't know. But there was definitely some, for example, some drops of blood on the back of Nicole that would have been great if they were tested. But
So the jurors who wrote this book continue on with their astonishment that police were not doing what police were supposed to do, not collecting or bagging evidence properly, not keeping the case, and it's suspect confidential. They believe that Detective Van Adder was running around town with the blood vial rather than booking it properly. Not transporting, refrigerating, or preserving the blood properly. With investigators Dennis Fung and Andrea Mazzola, I just cannot believe that they didn't have the proper training. They just got caught mishandling stuff and then tried to cover it up with explanations that never add up. Okay. And you've talked about this, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I have. But, you know, the whole point of putting blood in a vial that has preservative in it is does, in fact, preserve the blood. So I don't think he did it was a problem with that. But I think that there was a lot less urgency before this case, and there was a lot more trust on the part of the public with respect to the police officers, that when they had it in their chain of custody, when they maintained that chain of custody, that it was the right evidence. And in this case, they basically kind of destroyed that presumption.
Just a couple more things in this book. They couldn't believe that an experienced medical examiner did not know how to conduct a proper autopsy. Dr. Golden made 30 errors in the autopsy, and the verdict was reached quickly. There was a lot of reasonable doubt in the deliberation room. There was just no way there could have been a guilty verdict. And the one thing that jumps out at me, they talk about seeing Simpson, his spousal abuse of Nicole, as adequate motivation for the killing. They insisted the evidence they reviewed was too limited. One incident with three little episodes. It wasn't until we got out that we heard about all the other incidents.
I agree.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's what I and Laura have been saying all along, that this should have been a domestic violence murder. That should have been how it was presented to the jury. And I think that because they made that determination, because Ito kept out so much of the information that should have come in, because the prosecution didn't put on a domestic violence expert, I think all they were left with was, you know, confusing information, mm-hmm. insufficient information, and OJ's reputation, mm-hmm. because it certainly weighed in. His celebrity, his reputation, his wealth, and the manipulations of the public by the defense team.
So that's it about the books that I was able to find. If you want to know more about behind the scenes on Vulture, there is a really interesting interview by Ashley Reese, who was 4 years old during the O.J. Simpson trial, but her aunt was one of the jurors. She was juror 1233, and recently Ashley sat down with her aunt and interviewed her, and it's very interesting. I'm not going to read it now, but I can post it on our Facebook page, and eventually our website when we get one. Do you have other questions you want to address, Jim?
There's a question from one of the listeners, and I'll just say the name is JC, not Jim Clementi. And the question is, don't you think they came back so quick with a verdict because they had been sequestered so long and they were just fed up with the court antics and each other? I think that is one factor. I think it's a factor that O.J. himself was allowed to comment on, and that they had been sequestered for many months. None of them knew that at the beginning. All of them were tired and frustrated with the process. I think that does become a situation that can influence juries and their decisions. I know in some of the trials that I've been involved in, either as a prosecutor or a federal agent, I have seen juries that basically got very emotional in the jury room, that were arguing, yelling, screaming. We could hear things coming
out. Oh, really?
At me. The jury room was on the other side of the court's, the judge's chambers, and we could still hear them screaming in the courtroom. So, and then sometimes they would come back to ask questions and, you know, for ask for particular transcripts and so forth. And we'd see that some of them had tears in their eyes. I mean, it was really emotional mm-hmm. things. So I do think that it is a factor that would have weighed in this case. I don't think it was the overwhelming factor, but I think, as in any case, there's one straw that can break the camel's back, mm-hmm. and maybe this was the straw that did it.
Those are the questions that Jim and I can answer, you know, unfortunately without Laura. There'll be more. And I think during the podcast, we should every time have a section of we answer questions as we're kind of going along. That might be good to.
Yeah, if we have time. I mean, usually, I mean, if we have 30 minutes of talking, it would be easy to do that. But, I mean, some of our podcasts are going into an hour and 17 minutes and yeah. so forth. So I don't know if we'd be able to do it every time. But we will try to answer questions online as we can and then sort of accumulate them and
again,
answer them when we can.
Keep those great comments and questions coming on Facebook. I really love when you check in on any number of topics. It's always great to hear from you guys and because, you know, and we have listeners from everywhere. It's, I can't even believe it when I go and see every corner of the United States, you know, the UK, Australia, Ireland, Norway. I mean, just everywhere. I can't even comprehend that many people are taking the time to listen to me. I can understand you and Laura, but anyway.
Just to give you an update on some of the things that Laura and I are working on, we will hopefully be making an announcement soon about a project, a network project that will be coming this fall that Laura and I are both working on. Really exciting project. And then the show Missing Dial has been announced by Nat Geo. It'll be premiering on May 22nd, so in a couple weeks on Nat Geo. Missing Dial is a show that I worked on. I'm one of the producers on the show, and if you look it up on the internet, you'll see that it's about hunting for Cody Dial, who was the son of Roman Dial, a famous explorer and TV personality, who Cody went for a long exploratory hike in Costa Rica and never returned home. And so we put together a team to go down there and try to find out what happened. And we did.
Wow. Okay.
And then another show that I was interviewed for on Investigation Discovery should be coming out, I believe, in September, called Unraveled. And it's a really bizarre and interesting case that I did some analysis on. And so you'll see me on that as well. And last, Manifesto was announced by Discovery Channel. It will be going to series, I believe, late in 2016 or early 2017. It's a scripted series. The first season is called Manifesto, The Hunt for the Unabomber, and it will be about the chase and the arrest of Ted Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. And I did that with my friend Tony Gittleson and with my partner in arms, James Fitzgerald. We were in the FBI Academy together, and then we served in the New York office together, and then in the profiling unit all the time till we retired. So we're great friends and colleagues, and we're really excited about that. He's also involved in the other project with Laura and I. So hopefully we'll have an announcement on that fairly soon.
That is a lot going on. If you guys can comprehend all of those, just doing one of those projects is a lot. Doing all of that, man, I don't even know how you're awake right now.
Yeah, well, I am very good at juggling multiple things, but that's what we do in hiatus. We work our butts off to get things done.
Yeah, people may not understand that. So Criminal Minds is on hiatus right now, which means that the show takes a little vacation, and that gives us, the cast and the crew, time to do other projects. I've been doing a lot of other projects. I just did my first virtual reality film.
Really?
Yes. And I got to wear the whole goggles paisanos that you put on. I mean,
but wait a minute. So they how do they shoot it to be?
That's a trade secret. But they have a special camera. There's a couple competing cameras, and if you've heard of Oculus, they have the goggles.
And so does it shoot 360?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've seen one version of that that a friend of mine used in one of his films, and it was pretty amazing. They set it up, and they had cameras in the round that overlapped, and then they had, I think, 9 laptops standing up sideways, all hooked into the cameras that all blended in all the pictures together. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. So it was great to work on that new technology and watch through those goggles. It's incredible.
So what was your role in that?
I cast, it's a film, so it had a storyline, a really interesting, I can't disclose it. But it was really interesting. So I cast the actors. The actors. And what I thought
you might have starred in it as well.
Oh, God. No, but what I learned is that I had a lot of great actors audition, but there are some actors whose features are much better for the medium than others. So that was interesting to learn, you know?
Yeah, mine would not be good for that medium, I don't think.
No, you'd be great.
I have an outstanding personality and nose.
You are cute as a button. Anyway, and then I also did, I'm doing a feature film starring Sam Elliott, which is super cool. And
I love Sam Elliott.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah.
He's got a much deeper voice than I do.
He does. So I'm doing a lot of other things. And my movie, The Tiger Hunter, won a bunch of awards at the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival.
What
Yay!
Movie? What are you talking about? You didn't tell me about this.
I know. It's directed by Lena Khan. She is a badass female director. The cast was mainly India, South Asian cast or East Asian cast.
Did you cast that one as well?
Yeah, I cast that one and starring Danny Pudi. If you know Community, do you ever watch Community? Danny Pudi is in Community. You know, it's okay. Anyway, people listening to my voice will know who Danny Pudi is. He is in the show Community on NBC. Anyway, he was the star of it. And it got a bunch of awards, and I'm thrilled because I work on lots of indie films, and you never know they're going to see the light of day. Anything else,
All right, great.
Jim?
No, I think that's it for now. I can't wait till Laura comes back, and we can start dealing with new episodes.
That's right.
I'd like to talk about Oscar Pistorius.
Yes, that's going to be coming up. So I think in upcoming episodes, I know you guys did want to, Laura and Jim wanted to talk about the civil trial, kind of wrap it up and their final theories about what they think really happened. We kind of buried the lead on that. We haven't really talked about
we want people to come back for more.
That's right. So, but after we do that, we plan to do the Oscar Pistorius story, and you guys have suggested many other really great cases for us to talk about.
And we will look at as many as we possibly can. And we'd also like to go back and talk about other cases that may not have made the news much, but that we have worked, Laura and I, that we really believe have incredibly important teaching lessons. And I think those are the kinds of cases that may not be as popular to the general public, but I think that they are the kind of cases that we can add to the dialogue about, and that way everybody will actually be educated a little more. One of the problems with just looking at this stuff through the media is sort of the shark week mentality. In other words, when somebody gets attacked by a shark, all of a sudden they report on 2 or 3 others, and then you forget about it till next year when they happen. But far more people get killed in, getting into their cars than get killed by sharks. The fact is that it makes everybody all hyper about sharks and going in the water for a little time, and then people forget about it. But in this case, when we're talking about people's lives and things that happened to them and how offenders got access to them or got away with murder, those things, I think, are really important to instruct the general public on, because it can actually help save lives. So I don't want to just limit our dialogue to cases that everybody's already heard about.
Yeah, or about celebrities. So, yes. Yeah, I'm really interested in those cases, Jim.
Yes.
Good call. All right, guys, that's it. Bye.
All right, see you soon. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
For advice or support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.